You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. On a recent sunny day in the Crown Point neighborhood of Anaheim Hills, the wind rattles the leaves of trees in a grassy area amid the two-story homes. We're on top of a hill with a view over eastern Orange County. The land from here drops off into a brushy canyon, brown this time of year. Like in a lot of typical Southern California neighborhoods, solar panels glisten like black diamonds on the rooftops of homes. And yet, a proposed solar project in this neighborhood isn't blowing over very well among neighbors. Now, you've seen the giant solar arrays on the way to Vegas, maybe even the solar farms of the Central Valley. But the proposed Anaheim Solar One project would be right here in the middle of a suburban area, one of the first to be located in a city residential neighborhood in California. It's a test, perhaps, of whether we can move community solar closer to the people who are using all that electricity. Reporter Susan Vallett picks up the story from here.
Dusty trails crisscross this home to coyotes, rattlesnakes, local hikers, and Jan Hoblik.
Morning. Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Good.
Morning. She's very friendly, just said. Morning.
Nice. Hoblik and his family moved here a few years ago.
We love the area. We love this kind of the seclusion. It's a little bit like troubling. You know what's going to happen probably.
We're walking a couple of doors down to check out the site where Anaheim Solar One wants to install a 3-megawatt array of solar panels on a couple of acres of a roughly 23-acre plot of land. That's enough to power about 2,000 homes. This project could be considered a test of community solar within a higher density area. There are only a handful of other community solar projects in the works around California, and those are in desert or rural areas. This one is about 20 minutes from Disneyland. We come to a little grassy area between the homes, and the typical brown hillsides of Southern California drop below our feet. A major transmission line threads the canyon behind these homes. Hoblik says he first learned about the project when a neighbor happened to bring it up at a homeowners association meeting. Now he wonders what this hillside will look like.
If you go here, you will see the steel construction.
Neighbor James Zwingman is also concerned. He lives about 50 feet from where the project would be built.
I thought the location wasn't the greatest to put it in right next to all these residential neighborhoods. I mean, I do have solar on mine, but what they're introducing is a kind of industrial solar plant, very large.
Zwingman says they bought here because they liked the open space and don't want to see it filled with something industrial like solar panels. Zwingman says the panels are about the size of a billboard and they rotate with the sun.
And, you know, the units are very tall. You know, around 50 feet tall. At first we thought they were just, you know, small solar panels on the ground, but then we found out more about them and the large scale it is.
He and his neighbors say they'd rather see more rooftop solar developed, particularly in nearby industrial areas.
We're not trying to push against solar. You know, we do like solar. We don't mind other, you know, housing or other things that, you know, the community needs. It's just we would like not such a large scale system next to houses that would obviously change everything of the nature that we bought this place for. So, you know, we're not trying to be NIMBYs.
Anaheim Solar One and a spokesperson for the city of Anaheim both declined to comment on the project for this story, saying it's still in the planning stages. The city of Anaheim is aiming to move away from fossil fuels and become carbon neutral by 2045, a state-mandated goal. This project would be a small step toward that. The state has offered incentives for these types of projects that in some cases help bring solar to less affluent areas that otherwise might not have access to it. Zwingman says one of the issues was how he first heard about the project.
It's obviously been kind of in the planning works for a while, and we just kind of found out about it. Someone read the back of their bill, you know, which no one really reads anymore. And so that was just kind of stuffed in there. And they did put up a sign, but not in our neighborhood at all. And so that was one problem.
Poor public messaging can often spark community opposition to new building in a neighborhood, even if it's an environment-friendly project neighbors might otherwise support. That's according to Juliet Carlisle, an environmental and sustainable studies professor at the University of Utah. She studies pushback against renewable energy projects around the country. Carlisle says usually there's resistance from a smaller, vocal group, like those closest to the project, but it's often because they're in the dark about details.
There's this sense of the unknown for those who are opposed to it. What will it look like? How will it impact the land? Will I see it? Will it affect my lifestyle or my property value or my view?
Carlisle says it's unfair to characterize this opposition as NIMBYism, not in my backyard, because there are so many factors at play. She says scholars have found that people are often against these sorts of projects because they don't feel it fits the space or environment. Carlisle says the other issue that comes into play is how governments and organizations handle these projects.
In some cases, the opposition comes from residents who feel or have this sense that they weren't being included in the process. So just by including people and getting their feedback often is enough to sort of diminish that opposition. They feel heard.
For now, residents of this Anaheim neighborhood are gathering signatures against the project. So far, about 140 people have signed on against it at StopAnaheimSolar1.com. James Zwingman says there's still so much they don't know, which is frustrating.
It's kind of in a preliminary phase. That's one thing that we're kind of missing is our, you know, how many transformers, how many, you know, how much noise is it going to make too? We don't know all these things. These are all these kind of questions we would like to ask. And we haven't really heard much from the developer or anything like that, you know, to kind of appease our questions and concerns.
So far, there's no timeline for the project on the Anaheim Solar One website or the city's website. Another question that neighbors have. Zwingman says he really does support solar.
I think solar is a great thing, but it also should be kind of hidden. You know, it's kind of nice. It's on top of houses, so it's not like so ugly, I'd say, or so in your face about it. You know, you put it on top of commercial properties and things like that, and no one's the wiser, and you save, you know, it's good for the environment and less polluting and things like that. So that's the advantage of it. But if you make such a large scale system, no one's going to want that.
But ugly or not, as the push for renewable energy sources accelerates, solar projects are likely to become less hidden and more visible across California. For KCRW, I'm Susan Vallett.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. California has that mandate to be carbon neutral by no later than 2045. But some places have even more ambitious targets, like one city, and of all places, Orange County. The city council in Irvine has set a target for that city to be carbon neutral by 2030, less than a decade from now. And it's one of three California cities to win a $1 million grant to help it reach that goal, something called the Cool City Challenge. And Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, is here with the Orange County Line to tell us more. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So, all right, Cool City Challenge. What does that mean? Who's behind it? Is it like a contest among California cities?
Yeah, so it's run by the Empowerment Institute. And the Empowerment Institute is this group that is trying to get municipalities, corporations, even private individuals on this idea of getting to carbon neutral in the face of a global climate change. So in California, they sponsor this. Okay, all cities in California, give us the best possible ideas that are going to show that your city is going to get carbon neutral by a certain amount of point. And so Irvine applied, I'm sure a whole bunch of other orange cities across California applied, but three of them won the $1 million grant: Irvine, Los Angeles, and Petaluma. That's the last time you'll have all three of those cities in one sentence.
2030, though, Gustavo, is just 8 years away, eight and some change. Carbon neutrality, of course, is the goal. What exactly does that mean? I mean, it doesn't mean no one can drive a gas-powered car anymore, right? Because you know that's not going to happen in 8 years.
Oh, no. But there's other ways to be able to cut down on carbon emissions. And that's one of the things that Irvine put in its plan. And Irvine has vowed, it's the first city in Orange County now to be carbon neutral by 2030. And so part of it, they have this plan where there's going to be, if there's, it's still not, none of this is, set into the Irvine law yet. They're just proposals, but making sure that all new buildings are built to carbon neutral standards, make sure to change buildings so they can become carbon neutral. And it could be as simple as changing the light bulbs or even changing the windows to be able to not use air conditioning that much. There's many different ways into this idea of carbon neutrality.
Are the people of Irvine behind this? This is, after all, Orange County.
Irvine's a little bit more liberal than the rest of Orange County. Always historically has been, because you do have UC Irvine, one of the big employers in the city, and a lot of their scientists have actually been covering or documenting climate change for decades. So the city council passed it unanimously, even though there's still one Republican left on the city council. And they, and especially the Irvine company, as much trash as I like to talk about the Irvine company, they have been pretty far ahead of trying to make sure that these new developments are a little bit more energy efficient than previous ones. So let's put it this way. There is no big uprising against it. And frankly, hey, for a city to win a $1 million grant, that's not to be punny, but that's cool.
All right. Cool, of course. Tell us more, Gustavo, about, because these are so-called cool block leaders, right? And what they're going to be doing, like at a sort of hyper-local level.
Yeah, so what the city, its big plan is to have these neighborhoods on their own say, okay, let's do these neighborhood blocks. There's already a lot of neighborhoods in Irvine. So get your neighbors voluntarily, say, what are you going to do to be able to become more carbon neutral or to lessen, your effects on climate change? So they're going to be tracking them. They could put it on a website. They could put goals for themselves and they could just track in real time. Okay, this neighbor did this, this neighbor did that. And so far, Irvine's already gotten 200 people to be able to sign up voluntarily who have committed to get their neighbors and their neighborhoods involved in this. And so what the city is trying to do is just expand this program, especially at a time where we're all supposedly divided. Anything to get people to be talking to each other and have a common goal, I think it's great. And then if it's doing it to combat climate change, I think that's pretty innovative.
All right. So you've got 200 people in the neighborhoods on a hyper-local level with these cool block leaders. You've got the Irvine City Council, which is mostly for this, right? They're behind this as well. Who are the people pushing back? Are there people pushing back?
Oh, geez. At this point, there are still some folks for sure. But no, I mean, it's interesting because the most skeptical person about all, against Irvine's goal of being carbon neutral by 2030 is longtime Irvine politician Larry Agron, who spent most of his decades really being a Cassandra about climate change. And he voted for Irvine being declared a carbon neutral, but he called the date aspirational. He said this during the city council, and he said this should have been done a long time ago, but that was about it. Larry still voted for it.
He still voted for it. What about other cities in the OC? Are they also looking? I mean, talking about Anaheim and the Santa Anas and Costa Mesas. Are they looking at things like this? Are they looking to Irvine as sort of an example?
Everyone's dealing with it differently. I mean, we've talked about in the past about the cities on the Orange County coast are very Republican, but they have to deal with rising water levels. In Santa Ana, they've declared that by 2045, all of the energy that the city's going to be using is going to be coming, 100% of it's going to be renewables. Irvine is also part of a group along, who was it? Irvine, we've talked about this before, where they're going to create their own sort of like joint powers, local authority to be able to buy, to figure out where they want to buy their energy from, not just Southern California Edison, but other renewable sources. So slowly but surely, all Orange County cities are figuring out like, hey, climate change is real and there's ways that we could fight it or at least make renewables more of a bigger thing.
Do you think Cool City Challenge picks up steam and moves on from here? I mean, quickly, do we have more of this coming in the future?
At least this is being run by the Empowerment Institute. And so those three cities, Los Angeles, Petaluma, and Irvine, now they're going on to their contest. And whoever the winner is gets a $25 million grant. So I think the more you make it money manageable for these cities, the more they'll want to do it.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, every week here with the Orange County Line. Thanks, Gustavo.
Gracias.
Well, let's step outside now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here, and today marks Dia de los Muertos, which is a Mexican holiday to remember and to celebrate, memorialize family and friends who have passed on. Here in Los Angeles, you're probably familiar with a huge annual festival. It's a Hollywood Forever cemetery, but I'm standing at another place of rest, another cemetery, where those festivities first began decades ago. We're at Evergreen Cemetery in Boyle Heights, where the first public Dia de los Muertos celebration was held in the city nearly 50 years ago. And here to talk about this rich history is Shmuel Gonzalez, a Boyle Heights historian and community organizer. Shmuel, thank you for taking us on this tour.
Yeah, and thank you for having me today.
So take us back. We're talking like the late 60s, early 70s. There's so much tumult. There's so much, you know, anger about the Vietnam War. The Chicano moratorium was getting underway, right, in
exactly.
the early 70s. Tell us what was happening at that time.
So what's happening at that time is that, you know, Mexican-Americans are being sent to the Vietnam War in huge disproportionate numbers. And so what happens is that during this time, many families are affected, but many people personally are affected by the war and start fighting against the inequality of the draft. And that does come to a head, in which we do have, not just protesting, but some deaths of some of our civil rights leaders and journalists at that time.
So Dia de los Muertos comes from that movement, the Chicano moratorium movement of the early 1970s. How exactly does it get started? Is it an homage to, like, the traditions of Mexico?
It was. You know, initially, Sister Karen Bocaledo, who created the Barrio Mobile Art Studio, later known as Self-Help Graphics
Self-help
and
graphics.
Art.
Self-Help Graphics, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, she was a Franciscan nun, a radical, chain-smoking, cursing nun who loved to make art. And what she had noticed was that when not just Chicanos, but allies, including Jewish allies, were shot down in the streets, many people thought that for safety, they needed to shut down the Chicano movement. And that just for safety. And she insisted, no, it needed to get momentum. So she wanted to find a day to raise the spirits. And it just so happens, only day she had available was November 1st and 2nd,
wow.
All Souls Day.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that she had remembered that someone had given her some information from Mexico about Dia de los Muertos, and she presented it to the first generation of Chicano activists and had to convince them that it wasn't morbid, that it was the way that we were going to be able to come to terms with death and celebrate people's lives and immortalize them.
There are, I can't believe this number, 300,000 people who are buried in the cemetery.
Yes.
That's the size of like medium-sized cities.
Exactly.
And, I mean, so we're talking about a cemetery that dates back into the 1870s,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 1877.
77. It was the first non-segregated cemetery, is that correct?
Yes, that people just about any race could be buried here. So you see African-Americans, Japanese people, Armenian people, the whole spectrum of what old Boyle Heights used to be, Jewish people as well. And this is a very, very diverse cemetery. And it's really important because it shows the deep-rooted heritage of a lot of people that don't get mentioned in the history books.
So here we are. It's the Day of the Dead. Let's honor some dead. Let's take a walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. All right. We've got groundskeepers here going around in their golf carts, I guess a cemetery cart.
Hey, buenas tardes. You know, if you come this way, we have the Workman and the Hollenbeck family that are, you know, names are all over,
of course.
You know, the East Side and throughout, you know, Los Angeles for being mayors and major developers and
bankers.
Look
at this giant obelisk right here that
yes.
says Lankershim. I know Lankershim Boulevard in the Valley.
Uh-huh.
This is the Lankershim family.
Yes, the Lankershim Van Nuys family because they are intermarried.
Yeah.
And so this is actually their family crypt here with the huge obelisk, as you see here. Just over next to them is also, you know, the family burial areas for the Bigsby family of, you know, Bigsby Ranch, basically Long Beach.
Long Beach.
You know, we're right across from, you know, a section here that really is probably one of the most honored sections created by the Grand Army of the Republic. And this was created in the 1890s. And it was one of the first places that Memorial Day was celebrated. And, you know, this GAR, the Grand Army of the Republic, they were basically like the American Legion for people that fought for the Union cause in the Civil War. And What most people don't realize is that right here, right up against First Street, right here behind the Grand Obelisk for the GAR, there's this headstone for Papa D. Gillis Scott, who lived from 1850 to 1926. He was part of the Colored Regiment, the 116th Colored Regiment, that mustered out of Kentucky. And so he fought for his own freedom when he was too young.
If he was born in 1850, the Civil War was 1861 through 65. So he was 11, 12, 13, 14 years old.
Yeah, fighting for his own freedom and came to be a respected paternal figure within this neighborhood up against what is the historic African-American community here.
And there's an American flag on the tombstone for D. Gillis Scott, who died in 1926. Biddy Mason is buried here.
Biddy Mason, yeah, actually in one of the hearts of the cemeteries over here. And, Biddy Mason is a rather interesting character because she, came to Los Angeles as the first African-American slave brought by Americans, and became useful as a self-trained nurse during epidemics and made a lot of money and doing so, and became the first black land mogul of Los Angeles. That's why there's a Biddy Mason Park in downtown. She would found the African Methodist Episcopal Church, the first, the first African Methodist Episcopal Church, as well as orphanages and many things. But it's not just her. We also have the Reverend Seymour, who was notorious for the Azusa Street Revival, the birthplace of Pentecostalism, just a couple miles away from here. And it's rather amazing that you see throughout this neighborhood that, like any other place in Los Angeles, as you look through here, you see that there is no segregation between African-American family, mogul families over here, and Japanese families over here, and people who were mayors of Los Angeles. This is just a place that has always represented a certain level of integration.
Was it always like that?
From the beginning, that was really one of the important elements of creating this as a cemetery in a diverse neighborhood, was that anyone could be buried here, so just about everyone is.
It's been here for such a long time, Shmuel, and I wonder, it looks like it's seen better days.
Sure, absolutely.
What's going on here? I mean, is it because new owners are here? Is it because it's a sort of forgotten place? But it can't be forgotten with this many souls here.
I actually got the honor of giving one of the English-speaking managers of this site, a Chinese company that had purchased this site and started taking great interest in what they were seeing, represented here, but they didn't understand the site. So I actually had to take them around and show them what the cultural relevance, and they were really blown away by the story. It's just that most people don't know that we really have this treasure here because a lot of people's attention has shifted westward.
Forest Lawn, Hollywood Forever.
Hollywood Forever in those different places where Dia de los Muertos has become central. And so it's rather amazing that in the place where Dia de los Muertos was birthed in 1973 with the Catholic Church handing out communion and the procession going down the street of indigenous people giving incense offerings, that it would be thrown into obscurity. And some of it was because of the movement of self-help graphics having been ping-ponged around to other places and having to rebuild. But the other is just our ability to forget in such short periods of time. It hasn't even been 50 years yet. We're celebrating year 48. And our hopes is that I was talking with the owners about we need to bring Dia de los Muertos back as a celebration here, not just people coming to decorate individually, but to bring the attention back that this is the place that it was rebirthed as a diaspora Mexican-American Chicano tradition for a deeply social and American purpose. here that we're able to share with all of Los Angeles. Look, everyone takes part of it.
A true celebration, true memorial for people
memorial
who are no longer
people.
With us and, yeah. and where it all started, right here at Evergreen Cemetery in Boyle Heights. Shmuel Gonzalez, Boyle Heights historian, community organizer. Shmuel, thank you for leading us on this tour.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this evening. Tomorrow, a new episode, and with climate change and longer, drier, fiery spells, can you actually build an entirely fireproof home? You know, I know the topic of climate change, like a lot of things going on in the world, can leave you anxious and nervous. Me too, by the way. But there is hope. And people who are finding ways to make a difference. Maybe you know someone or a group doing something big or small to turn the tide. Maybe even you're doing something. Let us know at kcrw.com/askgreaterla. And while you're there, subscribe to the podcast as well. Get the show delivered fresh to your feed. kcrw.com/askgreaterla. For all of us at GLA, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and time tonight. Have yourself a great night.